want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear an interview that was taped for video with journalist Reese Ehrlich. His new book is called Inside Syria, and he's written about this region, first about Iran, then about Iraq. The new book Inside Syria is subtitled The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And Reese Ehrlich has traveled the region and interviewed all sides of this complicated dispute. He brings us some very interesting comments in this hour-long in-depth interview. I want to thank the people who support my work through your subscriptions to the podcast. Folks like Abby McMillan, who does much more than she has to, Gary Washington and Chris Welsh, and Robert Reynolds, who just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, one and all. And if you're not a subscriber, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, you click the link that says sign up, and it takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription.
War. Either join us or get out of the way. There's only today and tomorrow, no yesterday. All your history books, we burned every page. It's the only way. Project for a new American century. We know what to do. We're close with Jesus. You better believe us. We're better than you. Iraq. This is an endless war.
Our intro music today, something I just found online from a band called Jamaica Plain. It was recorded back in 2007, and it's called Endless War.
Project for a new American century. We know what to do. Either join us or get out of the way. Choking on pretzels, cross-eyed and drooling, he walks up to the camera and declares war. Either join us or get out of the way. There's only today and tomorrow, no yesterday. All your history books, we burned every page. It's the only way. Project for a new American century. We know what to do. We're close with Jesus. You better believe us. We're better than you. Iraq. This is an endless war.
Our intro music today, a song called Endless War. I just found this online. The group is Jamaica Plain, and it was released in 2007. From Marin TV, this is an in-depth interview special. I'm Peter B. Collins. My guest today is Reese Ehrlich, a Bay Area freelance radio and print journalist and the author of four books. For many years, he's focused on the Middle East with insightful books on Iraq and Iran. In 2012, he produced and anchored a public radio documentary, Inside the Syrian Uprising. I just finished reading his new book, Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And it's a fascinating book that I learned a lot from because it covers virtually every angle of this very complicated conflict. Reese, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's real, my pleasure.
Syria takes on increased significance with President Obama's recent decisions to launch U.S. airstrikes in Syria and Iraq with twin objectives of taking down the Sunni fighters who call themselves the Islamic State and the government of Bashar al-Assad. You've had at least two one-on-one interviews with Assad, and I want to ask you about them in a bit. And you've talked to all sides of this complicated conflict, and I want you to share some of those perspectives with us this hour. But I'd like to begin by reading from the very end of your book. You say, in the course of writing this book, I reported from Washington, D.C., and 10 countries in the Middle East. I met with leaders, rebels, analysts, and ordinary people. Most agreed on the basic facts about the Syrian uprising. Spontaneous, popular demonstrations broke out against Assad as part of the wider Arab Spring. Harsh repression followed. Syrian opposition forces turned to armed rebellion. The longer the fighting continued, the more foreign powers interfered. Russia sent massive amounts of arms and provided diplomatic cover for Assad's repression. Iran sent arms and military advisors, and it facilitated the entry into Syria of Hezbollah and Iraqi militias. The United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel all backed the rebels. The CIA trained selected rebels in Jordan. Foreigners bolstered the ranks of Al-Qaeda-affiliated and other extremist rebels, further complicating matters. Now, in a couple of paragraphs, you have succinctly described the very complex array of forces and interests, including proxy fighters, who are active in Syria today. It's much more complicated than most Americans think, isn't it?
It certainly is, and it's getting more complicated every day now, especially that the U.S. has started bombing in Syria. But basically, an indigenous popular uprising has gotten hijacked as a result of repression by the Syrian government and meddling by outside powers. And now, what could be more meddling than bombing? A year ago, the U.S. was going to bomb Syria over chemical weapons issues. It was planning to overthrow Assad and hopefully bring a pro-U.S. government to power in Damascus. Well, now we're bombing the people opposed to Assad. Assad is very pleased with our latest bombing efforts because we're bombing his enemies. I mean, what kind of upside-down, screwy policies is the U.S. pursuing?
Well, and it's hard to apply coherent thinking to what is a pretty incoherent situation, and layered above that are strategies that don't appear to be rational or well thought out. And so let me pose this question to you. If President Obama's greatest objectives are achieved, and without inserting U.S. ground troops, airstrikes alone are able to degrade and destroy, as he describes it, the Islamic State forces, and then we might succeed in taking out Assad, what do we have?
Well, if you want the Obama administration's argument, we have a pro-U.S. regime, so-called moderates, in power in Damascus, and a pro-U.S. regime in Baghdad. There's only one small problem. It ain't going to work. There's so many holes in this war plans that it's hard to know where to begin. But let's start with the fact that you can't win a war by airstrikes alone. You need to have some kind of forces on the ground. Obama claims he doesn't want to introduce more U.S. fighters. There are already some there. But how are you going to do it? In the Iraqi part of the Arab part of Iraq, the Iraqi army has proven itself to be incompetent, corrupt, and politically riven, religiously riven. In Syria, there's even less forces. So who exactly is going to take over these towns that the Syrian rebels, the Islamic State, currently controls? There is nobody. And that's why there's more and more calls by hawks, both Republicans and Democrats, to send in ground troops. That's the only way we can win it. And sure enough, you wait and see. There's going to be not only increasing pressure, but I think they're going to start sending in U.S. ground troops in greater numbers.
I share that view. I think that the pledge by President Obama not to insert American forces on the ground is one that will evaporate. And particularly, the airstrikes don't make us invulnerable. And we're using helicopter gunships that are easy to shoot down. We did an airdrop of supplies to the Kurdish fighters trying to hold the town of Kobani. And at least one of the pallets was intercepted by the enemy.
Yeah.
And
the Islamic State is fighting with American weapons. People want to know, well, where did they get their guns? From America or from American allies that abandoned them.
Well, let's take a moment here to talk about the origins of the group that calls itself Islamic State. Because a year ago, when they had not turned on the U.S. and were not at that point talking about creating a caliphate, including portions of Iraq and Syria, the U.S. considered them just another rebel force aligned with our interests against the Assad dictatorship. But when...
Well, that's not quite accurate.
All right.
The Islamic State was part of the al-Nusra Front, which was the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. And the al-Nusra Front was on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. So the U.S. had opposed that political trend among the rebels from the beginning. The problem was that the U.S. allies didn't get the message or chose to ignore the message. So I did a story from Saudi Arabia for Global Post in which I showed how the Saudi government, as well as wealthy individuals in the Gulf and in Saudi Arabia, were backing the Nusra Front because they appeared to be the most effective fighting force, even though they had this extremist ideology. And the Islamic State later split from the al-Nusra Front to become its own organization. It considers the Nusra Front to be a bunch of pansy liberals and, wusses.
Well, and that split caused what is considered to be al-Qaeda HQ, and the surviving leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, to disown the Islamic State, which is bizarre. We've never heard of a franchise of al-Qaeda being canceled.
It's a first for them, too. No, the tactics that were being used by the Islamic State drew the ire of even Osama bin Laden when he was alive. The problem was, and this is where the U.S. version of what al-Qaeda is doesn't really hold up, it's not a centralized command and control.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some leadership hold up in that case in Pakistan, but the individual local groups basically did what they wanted. And the Islamics, there are real differences between the Islamic State and the Nusra, mainly around when to declare this caliphate and what impact it has. So the Nusra front, at least to some extent, is willing to fight alongside of other rebel groups and hold its demands for a caliphate for a later time, whereas the Islamic State has implemented it. They claim they're running a government today, and they tolerate no dissent. They tolerate no opposition from any sources, including amongst their fellow Sunni rebels. And that's, frankly, one of the things that's going to make it very difficult for them to rule in the long run. They're already facing rebellions from Sunni Arabs because of their extremism.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly fair to say that these Sunni extremists, Sunni radicals who, again, call themselves ISIL or the Islamic State, are brutal.
Mm-hmm.
They have created this series of propaganda videos with alleged beheadings. They're selectively edited, and there's some issues about the credibility of these videos. Nonetheless, their barbaric acts, including threatening to wipe out the Yazidis, massacres of Shiites in large numbers in the towns that they have taken over in Iraq. they are, a formidable force and a very dark one. At the same time, it appears that this is, we have a, pardon me, a kind of selective outrage over their barbaric acts. And, you know, the beheading of a Westerner certainly gets a lot of mileage, a lot of emotional response. But war is brutal, and you have been to almost every part of this region, and there aren't any good guys. This is a film noir. And just as one example...
Well, even a film noir had somebody you were rooting for by the end of the movie.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia beheaded 59 yes. people this year.
Yes.
They beheaded more people in the month of August than the Islamic State has of Westerners in its existence. And yet we...
But those are the good guys, so it doesn't count.
Right. We claim Saudi Arabia as an ally, so we don't hold them to the same standard of the rebels.
No, that's absolutely true. The Islamic State, I saw firsthand the impact of the brutality of the Islamic State. I interviewed Yazidis who had been forced to flee their hometowns and villages and cut across the mountainous terrain into Syria and then back into the Kurdish region of Iraq. Anybody who disagreed with them, anybody of a minority religion, was fair game. It's ethnic cleansing,
mm-hmm.
and it's horrific. But the Islamic State is certainly a danger to the people of Iraq and Syria, but it's not a danger to the people of the United States. And that's where this question of the beheadings comes in. People were outraged in the United States when they saw that. As a freelance journalist who's been in that area, I was outraged myself. But that still doesn't justify bombing civilians and bombing people in Syria and Iraq. And in fact, it has the opposite effect of what the U.S. intends, because now the Islamic State is under, you know, is carrying the banner of anti-U.S. imperialism, anti-Zionism. People are flocking to join them because they seem to be a winning force who's taking up the anti-imperialist banner. And, of course, that's not what the U.S. intends, but that's what the bombing is the end result.
Reese, Leon Panetta, former congressman, who served as CIA director in the first Obama term and then moved over to the Defense Department as Pentagon chief. He's on a book tour, and he is repeating some of the things that he advocated when he was inside the administration. He wanted to attack Syria much earlier than President Obama agreed to. But I find his commentary a little hollow, because he doesn't acknowledge the failures under his watch at both CIA and the Pentagon. And in particular, that the failed policies of the U.S. created the opening for what is now called the Islamic State to surface. And I take a look critically at the so-called surge. Mm-hmm. Leon Panetta was on the Iraqi study group when George W. Bush, at the end of 2006, surprised people and said, we're going to put more troops into Iraq, and we have this plan developed by General Petraeus that essentially was to separate Sunni and Shia neighborhoods in Baghdad and elsewhere, to pay Sunnis in Anbar province, essentially not to shoot Americans, or at least for a while. And the surge did put a lid on the civil war and the partitioning of Iraq, which has occurred, I think,
since then. It put a lid for a time.
Yes. But I think it was a failed strategy, and no one really brings that up on Leon Panetta's book tour and asks him to answer for that.
I bet you if he appeared on this show, you'd ask him. yes, we go back just even a little bit further than that. In 2003, prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there was no Islamic State or similar extremist group in Iraq. They simply didn't exist. And the whole myth that the U.S. promulgated in order to justify the invasion, in addition to the question of the weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. There was also the claim that he was harboring terrorists who were going to be given suitcase bombs, maybe nuclear suitcase bombs, to blow up Chicago. And remember all that?
Mm-hmm.
The extremist groups began under the U.S. occupation in response to the U.S. occupation. There were all kinds of people joined the rebellion, including the groups that were later to evolve into the Islamic State. So in 2007, they were doing similar things to what they're doing now, which was to brutally oppress the Sunnis in the Anbar region and other places in the middle to north parts of Iraq. And the surge initially appeared to work because the local Sunnis were so angry at what was then called Al-Qaeda in Iraq or Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. They were so angry at them, they were even willing to join with the Americans to kick them out and to get them out of power. And the U.S. was very clever in that. And so it wasn't a success because all these U.S. troops came over, but because of the alienation that the Islamic State or the group that preceded it imposed. So then the next part of that was the agreement to pull out the U.S. troops. In Panetta's book and in book tour speeches, he claims that the Obama administration just didn't fight hard enough to keep the U.S. troops there. What bogus baloney. Bogus baloney, definitely. I can't think of another B, but anyway.
Well, we're on cable, and you can say bullshit if you want.
I am shocked. Yes, bogus baloney bullshit. The Bush administration signed the agreement to pull all U.S. troops out by the end of 2011. The Bush administration, not the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true. They signed it using an age-old American negotiating tactic, which is they had their fingers crossed. They never intended to actually carry it out. But the Iraqis weren't stupid. They knew that if a Republican was still in power, it probably wouldn't get implemented. But if Obama came in, at least there might be a chance. So all that happened under Obama's watch was that the U.S. was forced to live up to what the actual terms of the treaty were that Bush had signed. And all this baloney that, I mean, the Iraqis, the Prime Minister al-Maliki at the time refused to renegotiate and submit the agreement to Congress, to his parliament, because he knew he would lose. The anger against the U.S. was universal. The U.S. got out because the U.S. lost the war, and that's what you do when you lose a war. You get your troops out and you close your military bases.
Now, in addition to the failure of the surge, in my view, the other big blunder was the de-Ba'athification. When Paul Bremer was put in charge of the occupation of Iraq, he purged all of the Sunnis from the Iraqi government. When Maliki took over, pretty much our choice, he took that repression of the Sunnis even further. And just as a reminder for people, the Sunnis have always been a minority, the Shiites the majority in Iraq, but under Saddam Hussein, the Sunnis were in power. And so to eject them from the government, and some of those people wound up in American-controlled prisons in Iraq, and these are some of the same folks who are now in the top echelons of the Islamic State.
Yes, and it's worth noting that the Maliki government, which was based on Shia political parties and a coalition of mainly Shia groups, refused to integrate the Sunnis back into the government system and wasn't real popular among the Kurds either. And those sectarian policies, which initially were supported by the United States, by the way, as part of the putting down of the excuse being the de-Ba'athification, as you mentioned, until it became so outrageous that even the vice president of the country, who was a Sunni, was forced to flee because he was going to be arrested by the al-Maliki government. So what we're seeing now, the reason that the Islamic State has been able to attract at least some popular support this time around is because people look at the alternative. And it makes sense. In the United States, if we've got a Republican in power that we don't like, and he's been messing up, what do you do? You vote for the other guy. Well, the Iraqis are no different, and for right now, the Islamic State, for some of them, is the other guy.
And so, as we look at this and the surprise in terms of the American government, and there is a little back and forth, President Obama has said that the intelligence community didn't pick up on the expansion of the Islamic State as they moved into northern Iraq and have now consolidated their control of most of the western Anbar province. Were you surprised?
I think everybody was surprised. I certainly was surprised at how quickly they were able to defeat the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga, the fighting forces of the Kurdish region. And they had, I've been following them very closely inside Syria, and they're very devious and very clever and very evil. In Syria, they fought alongside other rebel groups against Assad, and then when in the city of Raqqa, which is now their headquarters, they then proceeded to explode car bombs and assassinate all the other guerrilla rebel leaders and force them out until they took over. So they're following a similar policy in Iraq. It's extreme sectarianism, extreme dictatorship. But the fact that they were able to seize power so quickly and meet so little resistance was a surprise.
And the reason Americans were told that the U.S. had to return to a military posture in Iraq was that the Islamic State was ready to commit genocide against the Yazidis. Now, how did the Yazidis wind up on this barren Mount Sinjar, essentially trapped with the only option to go over the hill into Syria, which had its own ramifications?
Yeah. Well, the people toss around the term genocide rather loosely these days. And it wasn't just the U.S. Some of the Kurds were talking about it as well. I mean, this was not genocide. Now, it was ethnic cleansing, which is bad enough and is a war crime of its on its own. Basically, the Islamic State are evil, brutal war criminals, but they're not stupid. They know they can't rule an area where there's significant religious or ethnic minorities that don't like them continue to live. So you either kill, basically what you do is you kill a few of them and scare the rest to leave and to drive them out. And that's what happened to the Yazidis. The Yazidis are a religious group. They can be Arab or Kurdish. They, it's a religion that only exists in that area. It's a kind of a cross between Zoroastrianism and Shia Islam and other influences. But they've lived at peace with their neighbors for centuries. The Islamic State knows that the Yazidis, the Shia Muslims, the Christians, and the Kurds are not going to live under Islamic rule. So they want to drive them out. And they try to recruit Sunni Arabs from those towns and villages to support them and to, you know, take over the houses and take the property. They forced them. I interviewed the Yazidis while I was there, and they had, and I've interviewed displaced people and refugees from all over the world. Not only did they not have cars, they didn't have backpacks. They, in some cases, they had a few suitcases, but in many cases, they didn't even allow them spare clothes. I mean, they had absolutely nothing with them. And, of course, had taken all, whatever wealth they might have brought.
So was it a justifiable humanitarian intervention on the part of the U.S.?
No. And here's why. It was very serious, but it was not going to end up in continuing genocide. They forced people to flee, and the point at which that happened, it would have wound down of its own accord. Now, that's not to downplay the seriousness for the people involved. It was horrible. But as I said, by bombing, the U.S. is having exactly the opposite effect of what they intend. They're now recruiting Arab Sunnis into their cause as a result of the U.S. bombing.
Reese, in September, a new character was introduced in this film noir called Khorasan. And we were told...
He's the guy with the fedora and the shadowy face that we can't quite identify at the beginning of the film.
Well, I did a double take when I first read about Khorasan, and in the space of a few days, we were introduced to this group, told that they're even more evil than the Islamic State, and that they had schemes to conduct attacks in the United States. A couple of days later, we were told that the airstrikes that were in part justified by the introduction of this new subplot had taken out their leader, or maybe not. Tell us what you know about Khorasan. Is this a real entity, or is this some concoction that was introduced to kind of add a new, darker element to this already dark saga?
Well, if we're continuing the film noir analogy, I think Khorasan is played by Peter Lorre, and he's very evil and very short. No, Khorasan was a group that nobody basically had heard of. And reporters, including myself, were scrambling after the U.S. announced What Obama said when he prepared the American people for the bombing of Syria, he said, interestingly enough, the Islamic State is not an immediate danger to the people of the United States. But there's this other group that we're going to bomb called Khorasan, and they have operational plans to attack the United States, and we hit their targets and prevented it. All right, well, that sounds pretty serious. But then within a matter of days, intelligence officials inside the American government were leaking stories that, A, the Khorasan, which was supposedly a super secret cell of Al-Qaeda in the Al-Nusra Front in Syria, turns out, first of all, it was a name the United States had given them. They don't have a name themselves. Two, if they exist at all, their plans were not operational. That is, they weren't ready to actually attack. If anything, it was at a talking stage of maybe there was something they can do. And there's a significant question as to whether they exist at all. And here we are justifying it for starting a new war in Syria. Now, the real test of this would be, if this was such an evil group that was going to launch attacks in the United States, how come we haven't heard word zippity-doo-dah since? It's completely disappeared from any of the propaganda coming out of Washington. Boy, that must have been a really serious... At least Peter Lorre keeps showing up at times in the film and looks sinister.
Well, Reese, the other element of this was, that was kind of confusing, is that toward the end of August, we heard voices like Senator Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, and others with shifting numbers of the alleged Americans who traveled to Syria to take up arms for the Islamic State and who are now being trained to return to the United States to wreak havoc here. And the numbers have shifted from a dozen to 100. At one point, I heard the number 200 used. The FBI director has said it's about a dozen. But I find all of this very hard to take seriously, because it seems that the primary goal of telling us about this is to create fear so that we will support policies that don't make sense on their face.
Are you doubting the word of our good Senator Dianne Feinstein in Washington?
I'm a Feinstein skeptic, yes.
Yes, well, and for good reason, I might add. This is another one of those myths that's right up there with the Saddam Hussein giving suitcase nuclear bombs to terrorists to blow up Chicago. This is straight up fear mongering. Now, are there foreigners joining the Islamic State and some of the and Al-Nusra and others? Yeah, there are. You know where they're from? Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. Stop and think about it. Who are these guys going to want fighting on their side? People who speak Arabic and who know the culture and the situation, or a bunch of Americans who can't even speak Arabic? You know, and so the numbers, there undoubtedly are a few Americans and Europeans who've gone over. But the very fact that there's so many different estimates means they don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not huge numbers or enough to justify what the U.S. is doing over there or new repressive policies here. I mean, I'd like to see a little bit more attention paid to these shooters that go into buildings or college campuses or malls and just start shooting people up. Now, that's a real terrorist threat, if you want to put it in those terms, not the people who are going, the handful of people who are going over to Syria.
And if I were to speculate, I'd say that the benefit of this fear-mongering is that we're no longer talking about the torture review that was conducted by the Feinstein Intelligence Committee, reformed the tepid, limited, watered-down reform to NSA surveillance is pretty well dead, at least in this legislative term. And so there's been a major distraction created even before Ebola entered into the media landscape.
That's true, and I'll add one more to the pot, which is, remember the sequester, when both the civilian or domestic budget and the Pentagon's budget were supposed to be deeply slashed, that came out as a result of the government shutdown and all of that. Okay. Well, the serious cuts in the defense budget are starting to be revised, because you can't stop you can't stop funding or cut spending when you're in the middle of a war. So the Pentagon hawks and the both Democrat and Republicans are using this latest war as the excuse to say we have to go back in and we need the more aircraft carriers and the supersonic jets and all the things that are actually totally useless in fighting rebels and guerrilla wars. But it's the perfect excuse to spend more money on the Pentagon and less on everything else. One op-ed in the Boston Globe I read estimated if this goes through, if they're successful, the cost of the war itself is $10 million a day, but the cost of all of these military spending that we wouldn't otherwise have made because of the changes in the with the sequester and so on, $100 million a year.
Mm.
So where exactly is that money going to come from? And what kind of economic mayhem is it going to cause?
That would be $100 billion.
Yes, $100 million. Right. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Yes, $100 mm-hmm. billion a year.
Yeah. So, Reese, there are many things that are fascinating about your book, and I want to recommend it to our listeners and viewers. It's called Inside Syria, and it's based on your travels in these countries and your cumulative reporting. You've had at least two one-on-one interviews with Bashar al-Assad. Help our audience understand what kind of person he is and to what extent you found him credible or not as he made the case for his crackdown on these terrorists who he says are trying to wreck his country.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I interviewed him in 2006, so it was roughly 5 years before the uprising began.
Mm-hmm.
On a personal level, he's quite charming. He speaks fluent English. He's an educated man. He was an ophthalmologist and doing advanced medical studies in London when his brother died and he was called back to become the new president. In 2000, when he became president, a lot of folks had hopes that he would be different than his father, and there was talk of a Damascus Spring and those kind of things. But when it came to the substance of what we talked about, before I went to interview him, I went around to as many Syrians as I could and said, well, if you had a chance to ask your president a question, what would it be? And I compiled all of this stuff and went armed with my sheaf of papers into the presidential palace. And he wouldn't admit anything was wrong with the country on any level for any reason. So how come there's roughly 300,000 Kurds who are still not citizens, even though they were born in Syria and their parents were born there and so on? Oh, that's an issue that we're dealing with. And, of course, he didn't deal with it for 5 years. Why not allow opposition trade unions, opposition political parties? Oh, that's a plot by the United States. Point after point, he always deferred it, blamed it on somebody else, claimed this is a long-term process. We're talking about possible elections, but we need a discussion about a discussion before we can even have the discussion. And so on every single one of the points, he punted or deflected it. All of this came back to haunt him in 2011. And had he made even some of those changes prior to the uprising, conditions would have been very different. But he really thought that he was an exception because he was an anti-imperialist and a pan-Arabist, and he had the strong support of his own people. There would never be an Arab Spring uprising mm-hmm. in Syria. Well, boy, was he wrong.
How has he managed to stay in power? We're almost 4 years into this civil war. Sanctions have cut off the limited oil revenues that used to come into Syria. The country is fractured. It's physically deeply damaged. How does he manage to stay in power, and what are his bases of support in the domestic Syrian population?
He does have some popular support, but mainly he's managed to keep his military and the financial moneyed elite behind him. Many of the smaller businessmen have fled or long ago broken with him, but he's got a system of crony capitalism, and those folks still support him. The military has not had serious defections, and a number of groups in Syria see him, whether they like Assad or not, they see him as a better alternative to the extremists. And, of course, the government does a lot of propaganda to characterize all the rebels as like the Islamic State, and has from the beginning, by the way, even when they, before the Islamic State even existed, they were claiming all the Islamic opposition were extremists. So Christians, Shia, Alawites, a sector of the Sunni community still support Assad. But remember, he only controls about a third of the country. And two-thirds of the country is under rebel control. So that's not very strong for someone who ran the kind of dictatorship he used to.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at a post-Assad Syria, one of the problems in countries that have been ruled by dictators is that there's no opposition, there's no bench. So there aren't people who you can easily identify as the possible next cadre of leaders there. Is there any, you know, and let me tie this together with the $500 million reward that Congress has offered for moderate rebels in Syria. Is there such a thing, or is this a myth?
Well, I'll take the second part first, which is the only way you can understand the term moderate is to substitute pro-U.S. So the U.S. wants to train 5,000 pro-U.S. rebels in Saudi Arabia, for example. And the U.S. has been trying to do this from the beginning, or at least from roughly a year into the process. The U.S. formed not one but two civilian organizations that supposedly represented the Syrian people. They formed the Free Syrian Army, and then they imposed another command structure on top of that. And most recently, the Pentagon now says they're not going to arm the Free Syrian Army at all because they're not cooperating with the U.S. in the field. And the U.S. has a basic fundamental problem. It can't find a horse to back in this race because the horses don't want the U.S. as a rider. The U.S. wants Syria to have friendly relations with Israel. They never talk about the return of the Golan, which every Syrian I've ever met wants. The Golan Heights was seized by Israel in the 1967 war and annexed later. Syrians don't like the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. And when the U.S. comes and says, we want democracy and rule of law, blah, 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 free markets, the Syrians rightly say, and where have you done this recently? What country can you point to as an example? Oh, like Iraq or something, you know? So that's at the core of the problem. There are people willing to take U.S. money. There's people willing to benefit from the U.S. bombing, but only in the short term. They don't want the U.S. in their country with influence for a long period of time.
And we've already seen blowback in the form of American arms falling into the hands of al-Nusra, of IS.
Yeah, everybody in the region has a long-term plan except the United States. The Kurds in Iraq want to become an independent nation. So we're now arming them with American-made weapons. The French and the Germans are also sending in arms. And the idea is that they're going to stop the Islamic State. But once the Islamic State is out of the Kurdish-controlled regions or there's some kind of a decrease in the fighting, the Kurds will very well likely declare their independence and use those same arms to fight the Iraqi army if necessary. So they've got a long-term plan. The Sunni Arabs that the U.S. is trying to win over to support and fight against the Islamic State hate the idea of an independent Kurdish region. They may well use it to fight the Kurds. The Shia-led Iraqi army is happy to take the new boost in U.S. weapons, but they're tied with Iran. They have very close relations with Iran, and they want to use it to fight in favor of the Assad government. They want to use it to fight certainly against the Kurds and against the Sunnis if necessary. So everybody's got the plans for the U.S. weapons, and the U.S. is just like pretending that none of this is going to – we have to focus on the immediate situation, and we can't worry about these longer-term issues.
Well, and your book really helped me understand, if I can put it this way, the different flavors of Kurds. And just like in the U.S. corporate media, the term Taliban is tossed around and rarely properly defined because there are distinct Taliban groups in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And likewise, the Kurds in Syria and that Peshmerga are different than the Kurds in Turkey. Help us understand the distinction between the PKK, which is designated by the state of Turkey as a terrorist group, and the PYD, which is active in Syria and has been claiming control of an area called a region called Rojava.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Rojava is the name for the Syrian Kurdish area as a whole. And let's see, it's complicated.
Yes, it
the,
is.
The PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, was founded by a guy named Öcalan, who's currently in a Turkish jail. And at one time, they considered themselves kind of a Marxist nationalist group fighting for independence of all the Kurds in all the countries to form a united Kurdistan. He gave up on that many years ago. No longer is on the left, in my opinion. He's a straight-up nationalist group, and he leads a straight-up nationalist group. And they've specifically called for autonomy in both Turkey and Syria, not independence. So when the U.S. and the Turkish government refer to them as terrorists and separatists, it's simply not accurate. They engage in armed struggle. Yes, sometimes civilians are killed, but that's not the intention. They're not blowing up malls and supermarkets with the intention of killing civilians.
Well, and Turkey has brutally repressed them.
Absolutely.
Inside Turkey.
And Assad also repressed them in Syria.
And also Turkey has run bombing missions into northern Iraq to attack Kurdish positions.
Yes. So the... But that doesn't mean we should have any illusions about the PKK. And they have affiliates. Some years back, they broke up. At one time, the PKK existed in all four countries where the Kurds live: Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Some years back, a matter of a few years ago, they broke up into four separate groups and claimed that each of these groups were their own political parties with their own leadership making their own decisions, but they were ideologically linked to the PKK. That's kind of a myth. I was in I interviewed the leadership in the PKK and other groups in the Kandil Mountains, and the Turkish Kurdish leadership and the Syrian and the Iraqi were all intermingled in the same camps doing the same stuff. So the idea that these are separate things is not true. So what we're seeing now in northern Syria, in the Kurdish area of Syria, is the Assad forces were extremely weak and pulled back from much of the Kurdish region of Syria. They still have their forces in some of the big cities. The PYD, as you mentioned, the affiliate of the PKK, stepped in, set up, they were the only ones with a functioning armed group because of the PKK's experience, and they run a number of the cities, towns, villages in the Kurdish region. And they're also the ones fighting in Kobani, in this town, Kurdish town near the Turkish border. They are, in my opinion, the least bad of an area full of really bad actors, which doesn't make them good. They're not. Mm-hmm. They are extremely sectarian. They run their organization like a cult. I've interviewed them now in all four countries. You can't spend three sentences with someone before they start quoting Öcalan and his brilliant revolutionary theories that apply the entire world and blah, 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 blah. They are not a pro-democracy a leftist group by any means.
So then is Turkey consistent at least? It has said it's going to align with the United States, but then it redefined its goal, which is primarily to bring down Assad. Meanwhile, it conducted some bombing sorties on Kurdish positions near Kobani, and then reversed itself and has allowed some Peshmerga to transit through southern Turkey in order to join the fight in Kobani.
I'm sure your listeners followed every bit of that.
Was it accurate?
Yeah, more or less.
Okay.
Let's go back to Peter Lorre.
I haven't anyway, been there, so yeah,
I know. You're a careful reader of the mass media and so on. It's really complicated because Turkey sees the PKK as an equal enemy to the Islamic State. And they want the U.S. to be fighting Assad, not spending so much time bombing the Islamic State. And they definitely don't want the PKK-affiliated group to come out on top in Kobani, which will very much boost their prestige and make them look good when the Turkish government is trying to suppress the PKK in the country. By the way, they're engaged in negotiations with the PKK, so it's very tricky. They're both fighting and negotiating to see if they can reach a political settlement, which would be the best for everybody concerned if they really could. But the right now, there's very few groups on the ground in Syria that can effectively fight the Islamic State. And what happened was the U.S. had downplayed the whole fight in Kobani as well. But as the Kurds held out and it became a popular issue, suddenly the U.S. is putting more attention. Now they're dropping supplies and weapons to the PYD in Kobani. And they're hoping that, to turn this into a popular victory against the Islamic State. But once again, the U.S. is making a tactical ally with someone that they consider to be a terrorist group, and it has its own long-term plans for having autonomy within Syria, which don't necessarily, in fact, don't comply with the U.S. plans for the region.
Well, we don't have any scheme to take those weapons back once we think they've done what we want them to do.
Yeah, my favorite one is the Turks agreed to allow weapons to come into Kobani so long as they turned the weapons back when they came back out through Turkey. Oh, yes. And I've got a bridge over the Bosphorus I'm trying to sell you.
Well, you can put chips on all those weapons, right?
Yeah, make sure, right. That's exactly what they're going to do.
Get them
now,
over.
Once the arms come in, that's it. They're staying, and they're staying with whatever fighters get them. Yeah, the Turks have agreed as kind of a face-saving measure to allow Peshmerga from Iraqi Kurdistan, which are controlled by another party or two parties that are not the PKK, to allow them to come in through Turkey and then into Kobani. So the Turks are hoping that by bringing in other political tendencies, it'll lessen the victory of the PKK.
So we've been talking about Turkey, and Turkey has multiple and perhaps shifting agendas in its stated support for the U.S. mission, whatever that actually is. But we also have this coalition that Obama says he has assembled. But each one of the groups of people who claim to be our allies has a separate agenda from taking out the Islamic State and, accomplishing the vision of the United States. And so this...
Almost nobody wants to accomplish the vision of the United States.
Yeah.
They want to accomplish their own vision.
So the coalition is also mostly for public relations, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The U.S. remains the dominant military and political power in this event.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, every time the U.S. invades somewhere, it's always part of a coalition, multilateral effort. The Vietnam War supposedly was that, but you look at it historically and you know that it was the U.S. war, and this is no different.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and Iran all have their own groups that they're supporting that they would like to see come out on top. And sometimes they overlap with the U.S. objectives, and many times they don't. So the classic example is the U.S. has told Saudi Arabia to train 5,000 moderate rebels. Well, if you look at both the religious and political ideology in Saudi Arabia, it's much closer to the extremist groups that the U.S. oppose. Their version of what the Middle East should look like. They oppose elections. They believe in Islamic rule, that's the basis for your political power. All the things that the U.S. don't support. Maybe the only thing they can agree on is free enterprise, but it's free enterprise for your cronies. So the Saudis are going to train moderate rebels. If there's training that goes ahead at all, I'm not at all going to bet you anything that the people who come out are anything other than extremists themselves. So the U.S. goals and the Saudi goals appear to be the same, and they're not.
Yeah. Reese, one of the real payoffs of your book is that you basically circle Syria and talk to all of the neighbors and the various factions that have an interest in this dispute. If you could briefly thumbnail, what is in it for Iran in the Syrian war?
Well, Iran has been allied with Assad in Syria for a long time. It goes back to the era of his father. It was based on a common antipathy to Saddam Hussein during the Iraq War, and they have continued the alliance ever since. Some people think it's for religious reasons, that because Assad is an Alawite, and the Alawites are split off from Shia Islam, and Tehran is run by Islamic mullahs, that somehow this is the reason. It's not. Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad were both secular dictators. They're Alawites in name, but they're not even particularly religious.
Mm-hmm.
And for sure, there's not a religious basis for the alliance with Iran. But so there's a political basis and military one.
I'm just moving quickly because our time is running out. But you go to Israel and you talk to Professor Eyal Zisser, mm-hmm. who basically describes Assad as the devil we know.
Right.
And he expresses comments that say that Israel is content to let Syrians kill each other because ultimately this is to Israel's benefit.
Yes. Initially, Israel, along with the United States, was very skeptical about the opposition to Assad, and they were worried that the people who might come to power would be worse than Assad. So they weren't criticizing Assad too strongly. But eventually they thought Assad was going to fall. And the Israelis are very happy with the current situation because you have Syrians killing Syrians and Iraqis killing Iraqis, and Israel doesn't have to worry about an attack from Hezbollah because Hezbollah is involved fighting in Syria. So right now, the whole issue of the Golan Heights has dropped from sight.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, the Israelis then proceed to massacre people in Gaza, the Palestinians, so they're not exactly off the hook in world opinion. But
well, they've also, as you point out in the book, done airstrikes into Syria on at least five occasions.
Yes.
And there are no repercussions because Assad's a little distracted.
Right. So the Israelis say that they're disrupting resupply efforts for Hezbollah going to Lebanon. But when you look carefully at it and where the bombings were, they targeted Assad's air force and military at times when they thought it would weaken Assad.
Mm-hmm. You also go to both the West Bank and Gaza, where you pick up that the Syrian war has caused a split among Palestinians.
It has, but not as much as you might think. It's really interesting. Assad and Iran and Hezbollah claim to be the resistance front opposing Israeli policy and supporting the Palestinians. There's only one problem. The Palestinians hate Assad. Hamas is openly opposed to Assad and is actually fighting and trained fighters inside Syria to attack the Assad military. And the PLO, or the Fatah, which is the other main faction that mm-hmm. runs the West Bank, they're officially neutral in the war, but they really don't like Assad. His father jailed leaders of the PLO in the past. They tried to get rid of Yasser Arafat when he was head of the PLO. So there's no love lost at all. And opinion polls show overwhelming numbers of Palestinians hate Assad.
Hmm.
So exactly how can they claim to be supporting the Palestinians?
One of my concerns is that this regional war could spin out into a world war, particularly given Russia's staunch support for Assad and the efforts to isolate Russia over the issues related to Ukraine. What are your thoughts about Russia? Will it stay on the sidelines?
I don't think there's going to be another world war. For one thing, there's not powers that could stand up to the United States in a conventional warfare. The reason we're seeing all these unconventional wars is because that's where the U.S. is weak and it might be defeated. I think Russia, because of the Ukraine crisis, because of what's going on in Syria, is turning less and less to relations with the West, more and more to China and to other countries. And I think there's going to be a period of continued turmoil and conflict with Russia.
One of the other contributions of your book, Reese, is to, without going into a college-level course, offering us some history of Syria, which was partitioned as part of the deal between France and Britain following the World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And one of the points you made that I found interesting is that in 1925, there was a crackdown in Syria by the French, and you say there are parallels to the uprising in 2011. Briefly explain.
The French had only recently taken control of what is today Syria and Lebanon. There was a great deal of anti-colonial sentiment. The Druze, which are an ethnic and religious group in both Lebanon and Syria, rose up and built allies with the Sunni Muslims, with the Shias, even among some of the Christians. And it was, they were so popular, they would get on their horsebacks with their rifles, ride into a village and say, "We're fighting the French, join us." And all the young men of the village would get up on horseback and follow them out of town. I mean, it was overwhelmingly popular and supported by anti-imperialists in France as well, and by the left. And what happened was there were weaknesses because significant numbers of Christians sided with the French. They saw themselves as beneficiaries of the colonial system because of the divide and conquer tactics of the French. And the French had overwhelmingly modern military equipment for the day. It was one of the first times an air force had bombed civilians in a war. Remember, airplanes were still relatively new at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought in, you know, heavy machine guns and artillery. They bombed Damascus, and eventually the rebellion was defeated. But it is something that every Syrian remembers, and the modern-day rebels, in fact, some of the strength of the modern-day rebels are exactly in the same areas of the 1925 rebellion.
Hmm. Well, Reese, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I thank you for your new book, Inside Syria. As I say, I strongly recommend it to people who'd like to learn more about the complex array of forces in play here. And I commend you, because it's difficult to write a book about such a fluid situation, but it's freshly published and very up to date, and I thank you very much for writing it.
Well, thank you so much. It wasn't easy, but I appreciate your comments, and thank you.
Reese Ehrlich, thank you for joining us today on this special in-depth interview program here on Marin TV. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for watching.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with journalist Reese Ehrlich. As always, I welcome your comments. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.